Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 29th of November. We talk about Mars, the first hour of our program today. Hour number two of the show, the author of The Black Banners, the inside story of 9/11 and the war against Al-Qaeda, which is a really interesting book. The guest is a former FBI agent from Lebanon originally, who speaks fluent Arabic and has remarkable things to say about how enhanced interrogation techniques do not work, and how, because of a lack of who knows what, the CIA and the FBI had a miscommunication or important files were not delivered to the FBI by the CIA, which could have prevented 9/11. So he's with us, hour number two. Bob Berman is our guest, the first hour of the show. We talked to Bob fairly recently about this wonderful magazine published by Astronomy, Bob Berman's 50 Weirdest Objects in the Cosmos. Today we talk about Mars. Bob is one of the best known astronomers in the whole world. He's able to translate very complex scientific concepts into language that people like me can understand. He writes for Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine, and the Old Farmer's Almanac. And if you go to, all one word, skymanbob.com, you can read his writing about a number of different issues. He says, as to the Mars program, he's written about Mars repeatedly in books, in Discover, and in Astronomy, and has addressed what this spacecraft is designed to do, something that we don't hear about very much in the news, and we will hear about it this hour. Of course, the biggest extraterrestrial explorer, this baby weighs about a ton, I understand. I can't believe how people can do this. NASA's Curiosity rover went up toward Mars on Saturday in a search for evidence that the planet might once have been home to microscopic life. It's going to take 8.5 months for Curiosity to make the 345 million mile journey to Mars. And we'll be talking about the goal of this $2.5 billion mission with Bob Berman. And welcome your phone calls, as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Hello, Bob.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Bob. Nice to have you on the air again.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I can't believe how you can take something that is this heavy and send it all the way to Mars. Is this just a real scientific feat?
Well, yes, although we've been doing Mars over and over and over again. It's been the bad luck planet, though. It's fascinating to me that in all of our probes to other planets, the Pioneer and Voyager spacecraft to Jupiter and Saturn, the Vikings, now the New Horizons going out toward Pluto, almost every one has been a success, and yet about half the spacecraft to Mars, which is the second nearest planet, have met with disaster in one way or the other. So it's really been a problem, and to underscore that, the big Russian mission to Mars that launched just a week or so earlier, one of its engines failed, and it's stuck in Earth orbit, and it's never going to go anywhere. So the Russians in particular have had a horrible history of trying to go to Mars. So it's challenging.
Why? Why is it so hard to get to Mars?
There's no good reason. It's the second closest planet. Venus is closest. Mars is second closest. And it ought to be easy by now, and yet various missions, even orbiters, have either gone past there, or fuel pumps have frozen up. And in one case, the programmers programmed the amount of thrust we'd need to slow down and get to Martian orbit in using English terms. You know, we use gallons, of course, and pounds of thrust, and the others on the crew use metric terms, and so they got their numbers wrong, and that mission didn't work. So it's always been one thing or another. So it's good that this one's off without a hitch.
Right. Now, tell me how long it takes to prepare for something like this. Is it years and years and years?
It is, especially because you don't just have the rocket, but you have, in this case, building a very complex rover, plus all the experiments. There are 10 separate science experiments, and these are good ones this time. This is a fascinating mission, and you almost have to back up, because Mars is our default one hope of either finding life there, which could still be there under the surface. Nobody has any idea about this, And our collective science fiction fantasies have always been to go there and colonize it. And Mars is all there is in the whole universe, because our solar system is so isolated from other stars. We'll never get to the stars, not personally, not with manned missions. Mercury is too hot. Venus is way too hot. And then going out past Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune don't even have surfaces. Mm. There's no place to land.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to land, you just go through soupy air that then turns into slush. So Mars, by default, is the only hopeful place for our fantasies of one day, you know, fleeing credit card debt and getting away from here. And so that's why we keep going back there. And then the history of exploring it has been so checkered and so odd. It's been odd.
Yeah. It's weird. You could put it in the weird category, I would imagine.
Yes.
You have written that, and we don't hear this being reported very much, that what we're doing also is trying to figure out the radiation hazard of sending humans there eventually. That's a big part of this mission, but underreported.
You're right, it is. And that's because if we're really going to send people into space, and the whole scientific community is frankly divided as to whether that's a good idea now or maybe even ever, because we can do so much with robots. All you have to do is look at the beautiful images from Voyager or Galileo or the Cassini probes to see how much we can do without jeopardizing any lives at all. And if we're going to send people, well, we need almost lost people during the Apollo 13 mission.
Mm-hmm.
It's dangerous to do that. And what seems to be almost the most dangerous, radiation. We know that once we're past Earth's atmosphere, that's one thing. But once we get past our magnetic protective barrier called the magnetosphere, the full radiation from the sun and from beyond comes streaming in. And this is not small amounts, especially when the sun does one of its hiccups called coronal mass ejections. And then it can be lethal. So astronauts during the six-month mission to Mars, this one's taking longer, by the way. We won't get this lander there until August, because Mars and Earth are unusually far apart right now.
Mm-hmm.
But during the six-month mission, astronauts are going to be subjected to radiation in space. And then once we're there on Mars, unfortunately, Mars has no magnetosphere. So it has no protection against radiation from cosmic radiation or from the sun. Some estimates of the amount of radiation that astronauts would get on Mars are as much as losing 15% to 40% of your brain cells.
Ooh, ooh.
In a 2-year mission, and even us smart people can't afford that.
Ooh, no.
This is not only would the risk of cancer be hugely increased by anybody that we sent there, it's almost becomes a sure thing. You're talking about getting a chest x-ray's worth of radiation every single hour you're there. Who's going to even volunteer for that?
Right.
And even though you could have shielding in the spacecraft, you can't shield it absolutely. And anyway, if you're going to hang out in a shielded environment, you might as well stay home. It's like going to Hawaii and then just staying in the hotel lobby.
Right. You know? What's the point?
Yeah, what's the point?
So are we going to be able to figure out the radiation levels? What instrument is aboard to do that, and will it be reliable?
Exactly, yes. And the answer to that is yes. We have on board a radiation detector. That's actually a fairly easy thing to do. And for the first time ever, we're going to be measuring the radiation flux on the surface by this nicely named Curiosity rover and just see what kind of hazardous environment there would be for humans if we ever go. Right now we're talking about, NASA's talking about the mid 2030s of sending people there, which I doubt will happen. I'm trying not to be a cynic, but we thought back in the 1970s during the final moon missions that we'd be sending people to Mars in the 1980s. In the 1980s we talked about the 1990s. In the 1990s we thought certainly soon after the 2000s began, so it keeps getting pushed off. Well, nowadays we're saying the 2030s, and really nobody believes it. So just so that nobody holds their breath on this, it's going to be, let's just say it's going to be at least 20 years, but it could be double that or triple that. And it could be the Chinese, flush with lots of cash and wanting to show the world how technologically advanced they've become. It could be that the Chinese do it. Then there's other thoughts of, well, don't bring people back. One way we could actually pull this off and save 10 or 20 years of development and sending people there is instead of sending humans there for a two-year mission. It has to be a two-year mission, you see, because Earth and Mars line up every 2 years. That's what's happening now. In fact, Mars is getting fairly bright in the sky and will come closest next month, in January, rather. I forgot that we're not quite in December yet. So normally you leave the astronauts there. You plan to leave them for 2 years till the next lineup of Mars and Earth and then bring them back. But what if you didn't? If you didn't have to bring the astronauts back, if these were people who were designed like the colonists of old, like the Mayflower pilgrims, like people who are just going to go there, start a colony, let's say you send the food there first, and their housing, and they just resign. Maybe they're older astronauts.
Or maybe their credit cards are really maxed out.
That's it. They don't want to come back.
Yeah.
And you know you'd find volunteers who would do this, who would say, well, we're just going to stay there. We're going to spend the rest of our lives here.
Oh.
Or at least 4, 6, 8 years, and then we'll talk about sending a rocket back later on. If you did that, and it was a one-way trip, you could cut off 10 or 15 years of development, and you could send the first humans there. And I suspect that the Chinese are going to do that and beat everybody to Mars.
Oh, that's fascinating. And where do you fall in the answer to the question, should we even be sending people into space when robots are doing okay?
Well, it's so much cheaper. You could do so many more probes without sending humans. You can do so much more. You can accomplish so much more science and take beautiful photographs that it's really hard to justify it. And I'd say currently we shouldn't be sending people just because we're not advanced enough yet. The probes that we do have they're not exciting a lot of people. For example, the International Space Station that glides above us, that circles the Earth. On paper, it sounds great that we have an international crew that's always there, that's in that laboratory, that's looking down on Earth. And sure, I'm in favor of that. I think we all are. But when it comes down to it, they're only 250 miles up. They're as close as Boston is to Philadelphia. They're not really far in space. And all those views of the curved Earth below are really kind of faked because they're done with wide-angle lenses that make it look as if the horizon is really bent and they're out there in space, when in truth, from the International Space Station, the horizon below is almost flat. And what are they doing? You know, if you ask your friends, name one astronaut up there or name one experiment that's been done up there in the last 5 years.
You'd be hard-pressed to answer.
None of us can even name that. So how exciting is it for what they're doing, and how important is the science? So you could even argue that what we've done so far is currently sort of at a standstill, even though the moon missions were exciting. So what's next? You know, part of it is, what should we do next? And President Obama has been speaking about going to maybe visiting asteroids, landing on an asteroid briefly and chipping a piece away, which we could also do with a spacecraft, by the way. And I don't know if that's going to generate that much excitement. I think for most people, it's Mars. That's it. If you're going to send people out, it's got to be Mars. But as astronaut Shannon Lucid, and that's our woman astronaut who spent more time in space aboard the shuttle and in orbit than anybody else, she's worried about radiation. She thinks that radiation isn't just a problem, but it's a stopper.
Oh.
And that, that the people that we send up there are going to get killed. And even if they don't get killed by radiation, it's very, very hazardous. And most people don't realize how perilous is the environment on Mars. Because even though there's air, it's only a hundredth as thick as Earth's air. And it's what little there is carbon dioxide. So you can't breathe it. You can't breathe there. And it's a very, very dangerous environment. And if it proves from this visit that the radiation constant flux is strong, and then of course there are burps of solar material that bring even more radiation unpredictably, it could make it impossible.
Bob Berman is our guest this hour. We're talking about the mission to Mars, which lifted off On Saturday last week, NASA's Curiosity rover is on its way to Mars. It should get there, I believe, in August. And Bob is a great guest, isn't he? I always learn so much when he's on. He's the Strange Universe columnist for Astronomy Magazine, author of, and we have yet to book him for this show, which we will down the road, The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. So any questions you have about this Mars mission, we'd like very much to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Actually, January 5, we have booked. Chrissy lets me know. Which is good. All right. January 5, Bob returns, The Sun's Heartbeat. Good. We go to your phone calls momentarily. One line is open if you'd like to grab it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. What do you think about the vision that he's just unfolded of people going there and just living out the rest of their lives on Mars? Well, sort of stops you in your tracks. Phone calls from you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Tuesday, Ali Soufan will join us, author of The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. He interrogated several of the key members of Al-Qaeda and got valuable information from them, not through enhanced interrogation techniques, but through outwitting terrorists. He will join us with some really alarming and fascinating stories. All right, let's go to phone calls for Bob Berman as we talk about Mars this hour. Scott in La Crosse, our first caller. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi, Bob. Good to talk to both of you again.
Thank you.
You know, while I was waiting on hold here, it occurred to me, listening to you talking about, you know, getting people to go on a one-way trip and everything like that, all you have to do is make it into a reality TV show, and that'd be pretty much it. Half the planet ready to line up to go.
I think you're probably right, Scott.
Sadly. Anyhow, my question is this, Bob. I know that when, actually, I saw when the, I think it was an IMAX presentation about the little rovers, Spirit and what's the other one? Sojourner.
Opportunity.
And they said that they, when they landed them, they actually wrapped them up in, almost like in a Michelin man suit and bounced them on the planet, and then they emerged from those cocoons. I'm assuming that this bigger Curiosity machine is not going to be one you're going to be likely to bounce on the surface. How are they planning to land it?
You're quite right. This one's too heavy for that. So they're actually going to land this one parachuting it down with a more gentle direct landing rather than bouncing. And even though that bouncing business was fun. And we should also mention that one of the other purposes, I mean, one purpose is obviously to kind of act as a reconnaissance scout for possible human missions in the far future. But the other is to really try to settle once and for all whether or not there is life on Mars. And it still remains an open question. There's some intriguing things about Mars that make some of us think it could still be there.
If I can follow up quickly, Kathleen?
Yeah, of course.
You know, I remember hearing an interview a while back with one, was it Viking, that where they actually thought they had found life?
Oh, yes, back in 1976.
Right. And wasn't it that one of these guys was still maintaining, you know, at least as of when I thought I saw him interviewed a few years back?
You're very informed about this. You're absolutely right. The chief researcher of one of the Viking experiments back in 1976, a fellow named Gilbert Levin, was and still is positive that they found life back in 1976. And the way they worked is there was a few experiments, but one of them, they scooped a sample of Martian soil, put it in a bin, and then added a nutrient solution. Of course, you don't know what kind of nutrients soil, bacteria, whatever is living there would like. It's kind of a chicken soup. We're going to throw them everything that they might find attractive. And then it contained a little bit of radioactive carbon, carbon-14. And on the basis that what does life do here on Earth? Well, life always changes its environment. For example, we breathe in oxygen, we breathe out carbon dioxide. We change our environment. And that's something that life does, seems to do everywhere. Well, after adding this nutritive solution with carbon-14 to the soil, sure enough, a stream of carbon-14 then was seen rising from the surrounding gases, as if this stuff was, these microbes were taking it and eating it and then breathing out the measurable carbon-14. And then after we heated, sterilized the soil, the whole thing stopped, as if we had killed what other organisms were there, and now it didn't happen anymore. And people were trying to figure out, well, what if it was just kind of dead chemistry that was doing that? And it was hard to figure out what chemistry could possibly have created that, although the majority of scientists ended up saying, no, well, all of our other experiments were negative. That was just a fluke. We didn't find life. But Dr. Gilbert Levin is still saying, no, we did find life back there. We've done this back on Earth in the lab, and it never gives us false negatives. So that's one of the things that we're doing now, especially since we seem to have detected methane on Mars. So there's still some hints that there could be life there.
Hmm.
I sure hope it works. You're a great guest. Thanks so much, both of you.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Scott, so much for your call. Let's talk a little bit more about those little rovers. They were, from what I have read, phenomenally successful.
Yeah, and they were plucky. Spirit and Opportunity. Nice names. I'm glad that NASA has gotten away from naming things with sort of, you know, we used to give objects names like Challenger.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought, well, that was asking for trouble. You know,
right,
who or what are we challenging up there? I mean, would you get into a rocket named or a rocket named I can't possibly blow up?
Right.
You know,
Titanic.
You know, you wouldn't do that. So these are nice names: Spirit, Opportunity, and now Curiosity. So it's a nice kind of pretty names. And you're right, Kathleen. They were plucky. They lasted for more than a Mars year, which is two of our years. And being able to rove, let them slowly scoop up stuff and go to other areas. And we're going to do the same thing with this Curiosity rover, except this one's even more powerful.
Mm-hmm. And how long is the mission? How long will it be scooping up samples?
Well, the initial mission is about 2 years, 98 weeks. But the way these things work is if it's successful for the first 98 weeks, it always gets renewed.
I see. Scott, thanks for the call. Sally in Middleton, hi.
Hi. Thank you. As you, specialists in this field, get together, or you singularly, don't you wonder where the universe ends, or if there's an end, or if there's not an end, probably there isn't, I don't know. How could it go on forever?
That's the problem, isn't it? The old question of, I remember it used to torment me when I was 13 years old. I would lose sleep over this. If the universe does end, well, if there's a barrier or a wall, then what's on the other side, and where does that end? But on the other hand, you can't picture infinity. And that's come back, actually, into play, because in the last 10 years, more and more of our measurements of the expansion of the universe, the galaxy, the Hubble flow, there's all sorts of separate bits of data that are indicating that the universe really is infinite. Infinite in extent, infinite in time, infinite in content. And so we're back once again with the notion that the universe goes on and on and on without an end. And it's not really difficult to picture. It's impossible to picture. So if you're having trouble, saying, well, I can't grasp this, well, you're not alone. Nobody can.
Do you still have sleepless nights over it?
Not anymore, because I realized that our science teachers back at school failed to tell us that there are things in science that you can say, that you can state, but that you can't visualize. And this is one of those. The way the human brain, logic, mind system works, there are things in quantum physics where particles do things beyond any of the choices that we can imagine for them. An electron starts out here, ends up there, and it didn't take any path to get there. And we say, well, how can that be? It has to have taken some route, some path. So we have a name for that. We say the electrons were in a state of superposition. But naming it doesn't mean that we can visualize what that means. So they're just things that can't be pictured the way our minds are set up. Our minds were designed to act symbolically, dualistically, to be very effective when we're ordering a cheeseburger or going out on a date. But does not work for some of these things like infinity, the macro universe, the universe at large, and that's just how it is. I mean, if a caller can call in and tell us how to visualize infinity, I'd like to hear it.
Thank you, and I'm sure somebody will attempt to do that. My mind can't understand, and please tell me about, and your mind is included in this category, of people who are capable of visualizing this kind of mission and then putting it all together and hoping, I hope that it'll be successful, but what kind of mind is it that can do that?
Right. Smart.
Really people. Smart.
And in this case, we have teams, fortunately, many, many people, both here and in Europe. There's French people involved in some of the instruments.
Mm.
And we have RTGs, the power source, which converts the heat of plutonium directly to electricity. That's how it's powered, so we have enough electricity to operate the rover and even operate a little laser. We're going to shoot little intense million-watt laser beams at little bits of the Martian soil. It's a new procedure. And then as the bit vaporizes, we analyze it using a spectrograph and see exactly what's there, how much carbon, how much oxygen. It can detect water. So we can just zap anything we want to near the rover and then see what it's made of.
Hmm. Remarkable. Chris in Wisconsin. Hi, Chris.
I'm always interested in information that falls through the cracks. And when I look at newspaper diagrams, I often see the nice gradual orbit where the spacecraft leaves the vicinity of Earth and ends up more or less near Mars. And I see illustrations of the final descent of the parachutes and the wonderful acrobatics. But what is often not reported is the following. Does the spacecraft approach Mars at the leading edge of Mars, at the trailing edge, or in between on the center of the sunlit side? Do you understand my question?
Yes, absolutely. And it's easier to picture what happens if you visualize the trajectory. And the reason that we only launch to Mars every 26 months is because that's when the and I know you know this, I'm just explaining this to listeners, because that's when the geometry of Earth and Mars are right, and they're only right every 26 months. So if we launch at that time, we're actually creating a little bit of a miniature planet that has a loop that starts at Earth's distance from the sun and whose far point from the sun, or aphelion of that elliptical orbit, is at Mars's orbit from the sun. So if you picture now, if there were no planets, if Earth didn't exist and Mars didn't exist, the spacecraft then would continue circling the sun forever, with a close point of the sun at Earth's distance, 93 million miles, and a far point from the sun at Mars's distance. But if you launch this at just the right time, when the spacecraft gets to the Martian orbit and is actually at that point moving sideways, if you can picture that, it's not even moving toward Mars anymore, it's curving sideways, just at that point Mars itself is arriving in its orbit to that point. So the two of them meet. It's the slowest point of the trajectory, and the two of them are actually traveling side by side at that point. So it requires relatively little braking to slow down and be captured by Mars into the Martian orbit, which is the first step.
And tell me more about this Gale crater. I have read that it's going to spend most of the 2 years looking at that part of Mars.
Right. Well, that's because the mantra, pretty much since 1976, since we sent the Vikings to Mars, more and more we've been saying we should follow the water, because the Mars topography shows that there was flowing water in the past, and many believe there still is occasionally flowing water on Mars. And life, as we know here on Earth, needs water. So if we can see the places that it looks like there has been water or maybe is still water. You see, water is tough because water needs pressure. A lot of people don't realize that you don't just need the right temperature for water. We all know that water freezes at 32 degrees Fahrenheit and boils at 212. You've got to be somewhere in that range to have water. But water doesn't exist unless it's under pressure. And that's why on the moon or anywhere else in space, even if you have the right temperature, you can't have liquid water because it'll just boil off immediately, can't exist. Here on Earth, the atmosphere supplies the pressure, which is why as climbers climb Mount Everest or any mountain, the water will boil off more and more readily as you get higher and higher up, and there's less air pressure above you. until on Mount Everest, water boils before it's even hot. It's barely warm. It boils at something like 140 degrees on Mount Everest. You can't even have a hot cup of coffee there, no matter what. So on Mars, the pressure is so little, you cannot have liquid water. If there is water under the surface, which is what we assume, because there's ice on the surface, so maybe on under the surface, protected by the surface pressure, there's liquid water, and then maybe sometimes it comes out like a spring, and if enough of it comes out at first, perhaps it can flow for a while before it boils off. But it won't persist. So when we see these places, gullies, like Gale Crater, that look like water was there, or water might be under the surface, that's where we want to go. That's where we want to look for life.
Yes. Did you have something else, Chris?
Yeah. Are they still using what's called a Hohmann orbit?
Yes, it's called a Hohmann transfer orbit, H-O-H-M-A-N-N. And that was the configuration that I just described before. And that's the least energy orbit. If you want to send your heaviest possible payload to an outer planet using the least amount of energy, because we don't, you know, these things are heavy, and we don't have infinite amount of energy, you use a Hohmann transfer orbit, and that's what we're using this time. And the reason it's taking longer, usually a Hohmann orbit will get us to Mars in about 6.5 months. This time it's taking 8.5 months, only because, although our orbit is fairly circular, Earth varies from the sun. We're coming up, by the way, on our closest point to the sun of the year, the first week of January, even though it won't feel like it, of course.
No.
We're fairly circular. We vary from about 91 to 94 million miles from the sun. But Mars is wildly out of round. Its orbit is not even close to a circle. And it just so happens at this point, this meeting of Mars that's coming up in January, we have the greatest separation between our two orbits. So the wide gap is there, and that's why it's taking a full 8 months to get to Mars this time instead of the usual six.
Thank you, Chris, so much for your call. Ed in Trade Lake. Hi, Ed.
Well, hello. Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Sure. We live in a moment right now where many of the world economies are collapsing. A lot of people are suffering. Our Earth here is far from utopia. And a lot has changed, especially economically, in the last 50 years since we went to the moon. And I guess I would like to just, you know, how many trillions of dollars have been spent on space exploration, and what has been the practical return on investment for a guy like me? I live on $700 a month.
Well, you know, that's an old question, and it's a valid question. I'm not going to try to be a kind of astronomer who says, well, it's what we learn and what we get from it. You can't even put a price on it. It's a valid question that's always been there. Now, back when things were cheap, or back when the government and private institutions did not have as much money, for example, when we built the famous Palomar telescope, the Hale telescope on Palomar Mountain, now that only cost $6 million, and that was the largest telescope on Earth for almost half a century. That was cheap. That was completed, if I remember right, in 1948 or 1949, and one of the first things it showed us was that the universe was three times larger than we thought, because the Andromeda galaxy, our nearest galaxy neighbor, instead of being 700,000 light years away, it was found to be 2 million light years away, three times farther away. And the astronomical community cheered, and everybody said, this is an amazing discovery. And people like yourself would say, well, yeah, but what does that do for me? Now that we know the Andromeda galaxy is three times farther away, how does that help me? Does that put food on the table? Does that give us extra technology? Does it help medicine? Does it help people live longer? Tell me one practical benefit. And so when you're asking now, what are the practical benefits? Most NASA people will, I'm trying to be polite here, will double talk. Let's just say that way a little bit and say, well, by learning about Jupiter, we're really learning about life on Earth. And don't forget Teflon. Don't forget Tang orange juice from the moon programs.
Right.
And there are some technological benefits. There are some. But it's not proportionate. To be honest, it's not proportionate to the money that's being spent. And so the simple answer, even though I'm giving you a long-winded answer, is that it's food for the soul. learning about Mars and whether there's life there and whether the universe is infinite, things that really won't benefit us practically, benefits our soul in some way, knowing these things. It's knowledge with no practical application in many cases. And then it's up to the individual, to society, to our culture, to say whether or not that is worth so many billions or, over time, trillions of dollars, or whether it isn't. I can't answer that.
Mm-hmm. But what if we have to leave this planet? Is it in preparation for us for our survival?
Well, Kathleen, that's the standard science fiction dream, that if Earth gets too polluted, or someday, and it actually won't be until another billion years, that the sun gets so hot that it's no longer habitable. But it's nice to have a spare.
Right.
If Mars is like a backup place where we could live, shouldn't we kind of make preparations for that? But I think that's actually a little bit mischievous, because that gives people the idea that maybe it's okay to pollute our planet. And after all, we could go somewhere else if we mess this up too much. When in truth, as we've seen earlier in the program, Mars at minimum is a dangerous, perilous place. The radiation will probably make life on there impossible anyway, if not very, very difficult, expensive. And we shouldn't think that there is a backup
mm-hmm.
home. This is our home. This is our precious planet. We have to take care of Earth. This is what we've got.
Bob Berman is our guest this hour, and we're talking about the mission to Mars that was launched on Saturday of this week, how long it is, where it's going, why we're doing it, what we hope to learn from it, why it is such a journey that is fraught with many dangers. As Bob started this program, he discussed how difficult it has been for us to successfully do work on Mars, that for whatever reason, a lot of the missions have failed. We hope that this one will not. Bob is a great guest. He is a very, very well-known astronomer. He is the author of many pieces in Astronomy Magazine, and he also writes for Discover Magazine and even the Old Farmer's Almanac. We had him on just a little while ago. This would be a nice, if you do stocking stuffer, or just a nice magazine to get to. I love this magazine. It's Bob Berman's 50 Weirdest Objects in the Cosmos. I passed it around our family, and we were looking at the pictures and talking about weird things. And I've had many a conversation with other people as a result of this show, published by Astronomy Magazine recently. He also has a book, and he's going to be again with us on January 5 for the book, The Sun's Heartbeat. More phone calls in a moment. We have a line open if you've been trying to get through. We've been crowded. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Tuesday, Ali Soufan will join us. His book is The Black Banners, The Inside Story of 9/11 and the War Against Al-Qaeda. He spent 20 years on the front lines against Al-Qaeda, was a former FBI special agent, and conducted several very important interrogations of people suspected to be members of Al-Qaeda. We'll talk with him about the war on terror. And that's our number two of our show. Bob Berman is here this hour, the world's largest extraterrestrial explorer. NASA's Curiosity rover is on its way to Mars. Liftoff was on Saturday, and we're talking about that mission this hour of the program. 800-486-8655 is the number. Mike in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, good morning. I have a comment and then a question. With regards to your previous caller and the answer that your guest gave, I kind of disagree. I think it's a question that we can't answer yet. We don't know what the benefits are going to be. It's kind of like Columbus, you know, when he left Europe headed towards America, nobody knew the answer to that question, and we know what the results are now. So I think the correct answer to that question is still somewhere in the future. It'll probably be good, hopefully.
Bob?
Well, hopefully, and the previous caller, just to remind listeners, was whether it's worth the money. Not just for this, the caller is asking about all these probes, spending many, many billions of dollars when there are needs on Earth. Is it worth it? And my answer was pretty much, you know, who can say? Because the practical benefit, the practical benefits probably are relatively small, but the benefits in terms of our knowledge, feeding our souls, giving us information about the universe, who can put a price on that? And is that price worth it? It's hard to say. It's really hard to say.
Right. Can I ask my question now?
Sure.
So, it's with regards to technology. So let's say in the last 100 years, technology has advanced more than the previous 10,000 years. And so my question is that advance of technology starting to slow down? Is it going at the same rate? Is it speeding up?
I mean, it depends upon what area of technology you're talking about. That's a general question that many might have different answers to. We all know that in computer technology, in medicine, some areas, it seems the advances are, if anything, are speeding up. Maybe in some areas the technology has plateaued. So it really depends upon what kind of technology we're talking about, which area of technology.
An email that's come in, how many instruments are on Curiosity? How many measurements will they take on Mars?
There's 10 instruments, and they're all designed to do different things, although as an aggregate, the idea is to find out about the Mars environment. I already mentioned the ChemCam, as it's called, instrument, which is very cool, firing an extremely powerful laser pulse, an infrared laser, and as you vaporize the little bits of material, you then measure it with a spectrometer and actually see what's there, and the rover can go around zapping little bits of Mars and discovering what's there. We also have a detector for radiation. We have a detector that will look for methane. Now, methane is really intriguing because methane can't really survive very long on its own. Methane is CH4, and the bonds are broken between the carbon and the hydrogen. So unless you have a replenishment of methane, either on Earth or on Mars, you shouldn't be able to see any. And there have been recent, although it's a little controversial, evidence that there's methane in the atmosphere. So the question is, what is producing the methane on Earth? It's essentially organic materials, about cows. We won't get indelicate about what,
right.
What part of the cow makes the methane.
Yeah.
But there's presumably no cows on Mars, so where's the methane coming from? So that's a little intriguing. Maybe it's subsurface life, after all, that's creating it. So that's one of the things the Mars Science Laboratory, or the Curiosity rover, is going to look for. That's very exciting. And we shouldn't forget that in 1996, NASA had a team assembled, and they actually announced that they had found fossils from Mars, from life, on a meteorite that landed in Antarctica. I think, if I remember right, it was 16,000 years ago.
Ooh.
A meteorite with a catchy name of ALH-84001. I still remember that name because it was so fantastic, and it really looked like there was the imprint of fossils from Mars that had been blasted into space by an impact, traveled between Mars and Earth for millions of years, and then landed on Earth. And now we found this fossil, this bit of Mars. We have over a dozen Martian meteorites in hand here on Earth, and this looked like a fossil. And they announced, well, here it is, absolute evidence for life. I remember being stunned at the time and how little excitement it generated at the office cooler. People went to work the next day, and people didn't say, hey, did you hear that?
Right,
life on Mars.
Yeah.
So when NASA keeps saying, well, if we found life somewhere else, it would be the biggest discovery ever.
Right.
And I'm wondering, in 1996, people didn't seem excited by it. In any case, later on, most scientists think that they weren't really fossils. They were just something that looked like fossils. But it still kept alive, this between that and that Viking experiment in 1976 that showed that nutritive solution of carbon-14 we talked about looked like it was being taken in by something in the Martian soil. And so all of this still leaves alive the possibility that maybe there really is under the surface, or maybe mixed in with the soil, maybe there's some form of life there.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, maybe since Mars cooled first before Earth did, and Mars was hospitable to the development of life before Earth was, maybe life started on Mars as bacteria or little plants or who knows what, got blasted into space by meteor impacts, and just like this other Martian meteorite, ALH 84001, landed on Earth, in the early Earth, and seeded the Earth.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
And these things liked it here on Earth because Earth was now friendlier and life then developed. In that case, we're all Martians.
That's it. We're just going to say that.
We're all Martians. And don't we want to know that if we're Martians?
Yes, yes, yes. I want to know that. Yes. Mike, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Rajbeev in Racine. Hi, Rajbeev.
Oh, good morning, Kathleen and Bob, anyway, and it's Rajbeev, anyway. Bob was saying earlier on that it'll be very dangerous for people to stay on Mars for any length of time, but I believe in a sort of we can reduce the risk of radiation greatly if the astronauts could live below ground anyway. I mean, you know, after all, you know, there are a lot of establishments, you know, that are below ground here, you know, the military ones and everything.
Yes, and no doubt the home would be below ground. But they would still, if they're going to be serving any useful purpose, be spending time exploring the surface of Mars, and then they'd be exposed to it. And so we really want to find out what is the overall Martian radiation flux. How much radiation are you going to get? Because you're not going to cut it down. You're not really going to cut it down to Earth-friendly levels. And will someone living there, even with shielding, are going to be subjected to like an absolute certainty of developing cancer in a few years? Is it going to cause the amount of neurological damage that astronaut Shannon Lucid fears that it will? Or is it something we can deal with? And that's one of the main purposes of the Mars Science Laboratory that's now en route to Mars, to find out once and for all.
Mm-hmm.
And one more, you know, thing. Another thing is this, you know, as far as the low pressure on the Mars anyway, I think, you know, humans are so distinct from animals, you know, and they just need more than food and comfort to stay alive or something and produce the next generation. Humans need to really use the intelligence to make the place better, for example. I don't kind of see impossible that, you know, with the science and technology, we can even pressurize Mars. I'm very optimistic anyway, and I think, you know, research and development doesn't have to bring in, you know, immediate cash, you know, or say, okay, you know. And one of the worst things that I saw this year, I think, when President Obama, you know, he canceled NASA's projects anyway. And I think, you know, I mean, to saying that, you know, we cannot afford it, I would say to him that, for example, you know, throwing all that trillions of dollars at Wall Street has brought nothing but more pain.
See, this is fascinating because we've now had two callers, mm-hmm. one of whom was saying, well, we shouldn't be spending the money. What are we getting out of that? I'm living on $700 a month. We shouldn't be doing it. And now we have another caller who's saying the opposite. And it's great that we're getting these callers because it really shows that there is a controversy and both sides are valid.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. We go to Tony. Hi, Tony.
Hi. I appreciate the time. I just wanted to call and check and see your personal opinion. I had to be that conspiracy geek that called in. Do you think if we found life on Mars that was more than some simple bacteria that it would actually be announced, or do you think that's something that we wouldn't find out till, you know, 50, 60 years later?
Oh, no, it would be announced. Again, the conspiracy people think that the government can really control what science agencies and the press and the media can say, but they don't. Again, with over 25 years with national magazines and stuff, I can tell you that if the government ever tried to say, don't say this or don't reveal this, we'd just laugh at them. We've run in Discover. We've even run articles revealing, to the extent that we could find, what kind of resolution was in the KH-11 spy satellite. We found, for example, that they can resolve details 11 inches across, which can show individual people on the Earth, but not reveal whether they're male or female. Mm-hmm. And we ran this. We you know, nobody said, hey, you can't reveal this. So if it was found, all the scientists involved would know, their husbands and wives and girlfriends and friends, so many people would know, and there'd be no way to keep it quiet. So if we found life, you'll know it.
Yeah. Now that you mention those cows, though, I know it's just silly, but I keep them. That's what's on my mind now. I think about the cows. Cows on Mars. Yeah. Well,
maybe red cows.
Oh, there you go. Red cows on Mars. Well, you're just a wonderful guest. Thank you, Bob, so much. It's been just a really informative hour. It's just been great. So we'll talk to you again in January.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bob Berman, our guest again. He was last on talking about, and if you didn't hear that show, it was really interesting. I can't remember when it was, but it wasn't that long ago. If you go to our, where do you go? You go to WPR.org and then look under Kathleen Dunn and you'll find previous shows. It was Bob Berman's 50 Weirdest Objects in the Cosmos. And we'll have him on in January to talk about his book on the sun. He is a columnist for Astronomy Magazine, and he writes for Discover Magazine. And we thank Chrissy Pease for producing this very interesting show. I love talking about space. And, well, we got another hour, so stay with us.